A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it starts with something I've actually done. Lying on a tile floor after exercising in the summer heat, maybe using a backpack as a pillow, and occasionally just falling asleep right there, and then waking up with a sore back. And the thing that got him thinking was, wait, tile floors are everywhere in the Middle East, and for most of human history, hard surfaces were basically all anyone slept on, so why does it hurt now? And the deeper question underneath that, he's a side sleeper. He tried to fall asleep on his back and physically couldn't. Every time he was drifting off, his body would just roll him back onto his side. Is sleeping position biologically hardwired? And if you had surgery or an injury and had to sleep differently, is it even possible to retrain yourself?
That last part is the one that grabs me. Because I've actually seen this clinically. Patients after shoulder reconstruction or spinal fusion who are told, you must sleep on your back for 6 weeks, and they look at you like you just asked them to breathe underwater. And yet most of them do adapt, so the question isn't really, can you change? It's what has to happen in your brain and body for that to work, and why does it feel so impossible at first?
Because we tend to think of sleeping position as a choice. I decide to curl up on my side, therefore I do. But the moment you try to choose differently, and your body overrides you mid-drift, you realize, maybe you were never the one deciding.
And that's where this gets interesting, because it pulls in biomechanics, neuroscience, evolutionary biology, and then the whole history of what humans actually slept on. Which, spoiler, was not a pillow-top mattress with cooling gel.
The oldest known mattress, if you want to call it that, is from Sibidu Cave in South Africa, 77,000 years old. Layered plant material, basically a thin mat on packed dirt. That's not a mattress, that's a suggestion of a mattress.
That was the luxury setup for most of human existence. Stone, packed earth, wooden platforms, maybe some straw or reeds if you were fortunate. The modern innerspring mattress only shows up in the 1870s. Memory foam was invented by NASA in 1966 and didn't hit the consumer market until the 90s. So for 99% of human history, we slept on surfaces that most of us today would describe as the floor.
Which makes Daniel's tile floor nap basically an ancestral reenactment, just with worse outcomes.
That's the paradox, right? Our bodies evolved on hard surfaces. Our spines, our joints, our sleep architecture, all of it developed in a world where bed meant the ground with maybe some leaves, and yet here we are, waking up sore after an hour on ceramic tile. So something changed. And it wasn't our biology, it was our environment. We adapted to softness, and now we've lost the adaptation to hardness.
Which brings us to the thing Daniel's actually asking. If you can lose an adaptation, can you regain it? And more specifically, can you teach your body to sleep in a position it's spent decades rejecting?
This isn't just a curiosity question anymore. You've got the minimalist sleep movement. People deliberately switching to Japanese futons, floor sleeping, camping hammocks. You've got post-surgical recovery where the position isn't optional. You've got people traveling to places where the bed is basically a board with a thin mat, and they can't sleep for a week. Understanding whether you can retrain this is suddenly practical, not philosophical.
Let's start with the history, because it reframes the whole problem. If humans slept on hard surfaces for the vast majority of our existence, then the real question isn't, why does the floor hurt? It's, why did we stop being able to sleep on it?
Let's put a number on that. The modern plush mattress, innerspring, layered padding, the thing you sink into, that's about 150 years old, give or take. The memory foam mattress you could buy at a store. That's barely 30 years in the consumer market. Before the 1870s, if you weren't wealthy, you slept on a straw tick or a wooden frame with some kind of thin padding. And before that, for tens of thousands of years, it was ground, stone, or packed earth with whatever plant material was available.
77,000 years of plant mats, and then suddenly 3 decades of cooling gel and zone support. Our spines must be so confused.
Confused is one way to put it. Another way is, think about what happens to muscle when you stop using it. Atrophy. Our bodies haven't changed genetically in 150 years, but our sensory expectations have. We've spent generations now sleeping on surfaces that conform to us, and our nervous systems have calibrated to that. So when Daniel lies down on a tile floor, his body isn't just registering, this is hard, it's registering, this is wrong.
Which is exactly what he described, right? He'd drift off on his back and his body would just reject the position. That's not a conscious decision. Something deeper is making that call.
That's the core question we're chasing here. Is sleeping position a fixed biological trait, or is it a learned habit? Because if it's fixed, then retraining is basically impossible. If it's learned, then it's just a matter of time and technique. The evidence, as usual, is somewhere in the middle, but closer to learned than most people think.
The history matters because it tells us what our bodies are actually designed for. We didn't evolve on pillow tops. The fact that we now struggle with hard surfaces isn't evidence that hard surfaces are bad for us. It's evidence that we've adapted to an environment that's only existed for about 4 human lifetimes.
Let's get into the mechanics of what's actually happening when Daniel lies on that tile floor. On a soft mattress, a side sleeper's weight distributes across the whole contact surface. The mattress yields under the shoulder and hip, so the spine stays roughly aligned. On a rigid surface, that doesn't happen. Your body weight concentrates on 3 points, the shoulder, the hip, and the ankle. The shoulder and hip are bony prominences with very little natural padding, so the pressure there spikes dramatically.
The spine just...
lateral bending, exactly. Instead of staying in neutral alignment, your spine curves sideways to accommodate the fact that your shoulder and hip can't sink into the surface. That's why Daniel wakes up with a sore back. It's not the hardness itself, it's the misalignment. His misalignment, his muscles have been fighting all night to hold his spine in a position the surface won't support.
Which explains why side sleeping on a hard floor feels worse than back sleeping on the same floor. On your back, your weight spreads across a much larger area, shoulder blades, pelvis, the whole length of the spine. The pressure per square inch drops way down.
That brings us to the evolutionary question. If side sleeping punishes you on hard surfaces, why do roughly 60% of adults do it? The Sleep Foundation puts it at about 60% side, 30% back, 10% stomach. Those numbers hold pretty consistently across cultures.
You'd think evolution would have nudged us toward back sleeping, given that we spent most of our history on hard ground.
You'd think. But side sleeping has some powerful evolutionary advantages that outweigh the pressure point problem, especially if you've got even a thin layer of plant material or animal hide under you. First, airway patency. When you sleep on your back, your tongue and soft palate can collapse backward and obstruct breathing. That's why back sleeping increases sleep apnea risk. Side sleeping keeps the airway open mechanically. Gravity pulls things forward instead of back.
Side sleeping is basically a built-in anti-snoring mechanism.
Built-in and, for most of human history, potentially life-saving. Untreated severe sleep apnea doesn't just ruin your sleep. It strains your cardiovascular system, increases stroke risk, impairs cognitive function. In a pre-modern environment where you needed to be alert to threats, a sleeping position that kept you breathing clearly would have been selected for.
There's the group sleeping angle too, right? The fetal position conserves heat, protects the vital organs.
That's the other piece. If you're sleeping in a group, which was the norm for most of human history, curling onto your side with your limbs drawn in reduces your exposed surface area. Less heat loss. And from a defensive standpoint, you're protecting your abdomen. It's the same instinct that makes a lot of mammals curl up to sleep. So side sleeping isn't a modern preference we accidentally developed, it's deeply conserved biology.
Which makes the just sleep on your back advice feel a bit like telling someone to just breathe manually. You can do it, but something keeps taking the controls back.
This is where the neuroscience gets genuinely fascinating. There was a study out of the University of Rochester in 2021 that looked at sleep position preferences in infants as young as 2 months. That's before any learned habit could reasonably form. These babies aren't choosing a sleep style, they're just doing what their bodies tell them to do. And yet they showed consistent individual position preferences.
It's not just habit. Something is preset.
Twin studies point in the same direction. Identical twins show more similar sleep position preferences than fraternal twins, which suggests a heritable component. We're not talking about a single sleep position gene. It's almost certainly polygenic, involving things like joint laxity, muscle tone, even the shape of your rib cage and pelvis. But the predisposition is real.
That explains why Daniel couldn't just decide to sleep on his back. It's not willpower. His body has a default setting.
The mechanism that enforces that default is what neuroscientists call the body schema. Your brain maintains a constantly updated map of where your limbs are in space, built from two main inputs, your vestibular system in the inner ear, which tracks head position and movement, and proprioception, the sensors in your joints and muscles that report limb position and pressure.
It's like a GPS for your body that's been running for decades, and the route it knows is curl onto left side.
That's exactly the right metaphor. For a lifelong side sleeper, the specific pressure pattern of shoulder-hip-ankle contact, the spinal curvature, the limb arrangement, all of that is encoded in the body schema as correct sleep posture. When you try to sleep on your back, your brain receives an unfamiliar pattern of pressure and proprioceptive signals. It doesn't interpret that as, oh, new position. It interprets it as something is wrong.
Then it fixes the problem.
It triggers what's called a micro-arousal. Not full waking, you probably won't even remember it, but a brief activation of the reticular activating system that brings you close enough to consciousness to shift position. Your body rolls you back to your side, the familiar pressure pattern is restored, and your brain goes right, that's better, and lets you sink back into deeper sleep. The whole thing might take 3 seconds.
Daniel's experience of drifting off on his back and then suddenly finding himself on his side. That's the body schema override in action. He was never going to stay on his back because his brain was watching the whole time.
That's why retraining is so difficult. You're not fighting a habit, you're fighting a neurological safety check. Your brain believes at a subcortical level that back sleeping is incorrect. The microarousal isn't a suggestion, it's a corrective reflex.
If the body schema is enforcing your default position with a neurological safety check, the obvious next question is, can you override it? Or are you stuck with whatever your 2-month-old infant self decided?
You can override it. But it's a form of motor learning, closer to learning to write with your non-dominant hand than to breaking a bad habit. And like any motor learning, it takes consistent, deliberate practice over something like 2 to 6 weeks. The key insight from the physical therapy literature is that you don't fight the instinct directly. You create environmental constraints that make the new position more comfortable than the old one.
Instead of lying there thinking, stay on your back, stay on your back, you make it physically harder to roll onto your side.
The simplest method is the pillow barrier. You place a firm pillow behind your back, or one on each side, so that when the microarousal fires and your body tries to roll, it hits resistance. You don't have to consciously stop yourself. The barrier does the work.
Which is clever, because it sidesteps the whole problem of willpower. You're not trying to override the reflex, you're making the reflex fail.
And there are a few other techniques that physical therapists combine with barriers. One is creating a nest, a rolled towel under your knees to reduce lower back strain, and a small cervical pillow to support the natural curve of your neck. The goal is to make supine lying feel so supported that your nervous system stops flagging it as wrong.
You don't just jump into 8 hours of this. You start small.
15 minutes of back lying before sleep, then roll to your side and sleep normally. Then 20 minutes the next night. You're slowly teaching your body schema that this new pressure pattern is safe. The brain updates its map, but it updates slowly. It needs repeated, consistent evidence before it stops triggering the microarousal.
There's also those wearable gadgets, right? Things that vibrate when you roll over?
Positional sleep trainers, yeah. Devices like the Lunula or the sleep position trainer. They're small wearables, usually worn on the chest or forehead, that detect when you roll onto your side and deliver a gentle vibration. Not enough to wake you fully, but enough to trigger a position adjustment. The research on these is still emerging, but the principle is sound. You're providing real-time feedback that gradually retrains the automatic shift.
The post-surgery data is probably the strongest evidence that this actually works.
It's the closest thing we have to a controlled experiment. After shoulder reconstruction or spinal fusion, patients are often required to sleep on their back for 4 to 6 weeks. Physical therapists use a graded protocol. They start patients semi-reclined at about a 30-degree incline because that reduces the sensation of vulnerability that comes with flat back sleeping, and they use foam wedges and body pillows to create that nest we talked about. Then they gradually lower the incline over the first week.
Most people actually adapt.
About 70% adapt within 2 weeks. But here's the interesting part. Almost all of them report that it feels deeply unnatural for the first 5 to 7 days. They describe it as wrong, exposed, like I'm falling. That's the body schema protesting. And then, somewhere around day 5 or 6, the complaints drop off. The brain has started to accept the new position as valid.
A week of feeling wrong, and then your brain just updates the firmware.
Which tells us the body schema is plastic. It can be rewritten. It just doesn't rewrite itself quickly, because for most of human history, sudden changes in sleeping position probably meant you'd fallen out of a tree or been displaced by a predator. The resistance is a feature, not a bug.
Which brings us back to Daniel's tile floor. The sore back wasn't really about the hardness. It was about pressure distribution.
This is where the cultural comparisons get useful. In Japan, floor sleeping on tatami mats and futons is still common, and side sleeping is still the majority position. But the futon provides just enough give, maybe an inch or two of compressed cotton, to distribute pressure away from the shoulder and hip. It's not soft, but it's compliant enough to let the spine stay neutral. In the Middle East, where tile floors are ubiquitous, people have historically used thick rugs or layered blankets as a buffer.
The lesson isn't hard surfaces are bad. It's that a thin layer of padding, 1 or 2 inches, transforms the experience for a side sleeper. You don't need a 12-inch memory foam mattress. You need pressure distribution at the 3 contact points.
That's the practical takeaway for anyone who wants to sleep on harder surfaces, whether it's travel, camping, or just experimenting with floor sleeping. Don't try the switch positions. Add targeted padding. A small camping mat or folded blanket under your hips and shoulders is often all it takes.
There's also a myth worth busting here, which is that back sleeping is universally better for you.
It's one of those things that gets repeated as obvious truth. Sleep on your back for spinal health. And for some people, it does reduce neck strain. But back sleeping also increases sleep apnea risk, because gravity pulls the tongue and soft palate backward into the airway. For people with lumbar lordosis, an exaggerated inward curve of the lower spine, back sleeping can actually increase lower back pain because the arch is unsupported.
The goal shouldn't be to switch positions. It should be to make your preferred position work on whatever surface you're on.
Side sleeping isn't inferior. It's just different. It evolved for good reasons. Airway patency, heat conservation, organ protection, and those reasons haven't gone away. The problem isn't the position. It's the mismatch between the position and the surface. Fix the surface or add the right padding, and the position works fine.
Which reframes Daniel's whole question. He was asking, can I learn to sleep on my back? And the answer is yes, with effort and time. But the better question might be, how do I make side sleeping work on a hard surface? And that turns out to be a much simpler problem.
If we're pulling all of this together into things someone can actually do, I think there are 3 scenarios worth addressing. The first is Daniel's exact situation. You're a side sleeper, you're on a hard surface, and you want to sleep without waking up sore. The answer isn't to fight your body schema, it's to work with it. A small camping mat or a folded blanket, even just 2 inches of padding, under your hips and shoulders changes the pressure equation completely.
Because you're not trying to soften the whole surface. You're targeting the 3 points where bone meets floor.
And this is where the history lesson becomes practical. Humans slept on hard ground for millennia, not because they had iron spines, but because they used whatever was available, straw, reeds, animal hides, as targeted pressure relief. A thin layer in the right places. Daniel's backpack as a pillow was actually on the right track, just incomplete.
The second scenario is the medical one. You have to sleep on your back after surgery or injury, and your body is fighting you every night. That's where the barrier method and graded exposure come in. Pillows switch behind you to block the roll, a towel under the knees, and start with short sessions. Expect a week of feeling wrong.
The clinical data bears this out. About 70% of post-surgical patients adapt within 2 weeks. The first 5 to 7 days are the hardest, and then something shifts. Your brain stops treating the new position as a threat. That's the body schema updating in real time.
Which brings us to the third thing, and it's maybe the most broadly useful. The modern mattress has only been around for about 150 years. Our bodies haven't genetically forgotten how to sleep on hard surfaces, but we've spent a lifetime calibrating to soft ones. Readaptation is possible. It just takes deliberate practice. You're not learning something new. You're reaccessing something old.
That reframes the whole discomfort. It's not that your body can't do it. It's that your nervous system has been trained on a very narrow range of surfaces and forgot that variation is normal. The growing interest in floor sleeping and minimalist setups isn't just a trend. It might actually be a way to maintain adaptability, to keep your body schema flexible rather than locked to one surface type.
Whether you're on a tile floor in Jerusalem or a futon in Kyoto or recovering from surgery in a hospital bed, the principle is the same. Don't fight your default position unless you have to. Fix the pressure points instead. And if you do have to switch, give your brain time to rewrite the map. Where does this leave us? I keep coming back to this image. We've spent 150 years making beds softer and softer, pillow tops and memory foam, and adjustable air chambers that sense your position and respond in real time. And at the same time, back pain rates keep climbing. It makes me wonder if we've accidentally trained our bodies to need something they never needed before.
There's some evidence pointing that way. Not a slam dunk causal link. Back pain is multifactorial, obviously, but the loss of sleep surface variation is real. For most of human history, you didn't sleep on the same surface every night. You slept on different ground, different terrain, different materials depending on where you were and what season it was. Your body schema stayed flexible because it had to. Now we sleep on the exact same mattress, same firmness, same position, 365 nights a year. That's not adaptation, that's specialization.
Specialization to the point of fragility.
The minimalist sleep movement might be an unconscious corrective to exactly that. Japanese futons, floor sleeping, camping hammocks, people who try these things often report that the first few nights are terrible, and then something clicks. Their body remembers. It's not that hard surfaces are inherently better, it's that variability is better. Your spine and your nervous system benefit from not always being cradled in exactly the same way.
The open question is, are we going to keep chasing softer and softer, or are we going to realize that adaptability itself is worth preserving?
That's the one I'll be thinking about. And if this episode made you think differently about your own sleep, whether you're recovering from surgery, planning a camping trip, or just looking at your tile floor differently, share it with someone who'd find it useful. And send us your weird prompts.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1723, a Dutch East India Company clerk shipwrecked on the Namib Desert coast documented that the local Nama herders spoke a tonal language with six distinct pitch contours, one more than Cantonese, making it one of the earliest European records of tonal complexity surviving from that era.
Six pitch contours in the desert. All right.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.